Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at Bordeaux.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We're good. We're live. Okay, sorry. I can't tell. This is the way we do radio here. The engineer's back's to me here. Come on, this is how we work. Headphones. Yes. Anyway, Michael Becker, yes, Food Talk. So good show today, all wine. Savio Suarez is my first guest. We'll be on with him in just a minute. And then I've got Erin Healy, who's a really young Somme who I met in Bordeaux during the 2015 harvest. She's working for Marc Forgione then, and now she's got a great gig working with Jean Georges. So we'll talk about her new job, what that must be like, that seller of his. But first, we'll talk to Savio. But before that, I want to give a shout-out, and I should have written all this stuff down, but I didn't. So Joey DeStefano emailed me last week to invite me to attend something, which is this Saturday night in Queens. So here's what I want you to do. If you like cheese and you want to go to Queens this Saturday night, there's this great event taking place. If you Google a cheese event in Queens this Saturday, it'll come up. He'll be there, Tia Keenan, who has a great new book out on the art of the cheese plate. Tia will be there with her book talking about cheese and cheese pairings. The guys from M. Wells will be there doing some food around it. And another really good restaurant. So there's going to be cheese, tons of wine, I'm sure, people playing with cheese, and it's in Queens. That's all I can tell you. I can't send you any more information, but you know how the website. You Google all that stuff in there into a search engine, and hopefully it comes up, and then you can buy a ticket and go tomorrow night. So my first guest today, Savio Suarez, who I kind of met. He's an importer. Savio Suarez Selections, the name of his company. And I kind of met him the same way I feel like I met Kermit Lynch and maybe Neil Rosenthal and Louis Dresner, which is through their wines. Like, I would go to a store, buy a bottle of wine, take it home, have it in a glass, and go, holy shit, this is good. Who is the importer again? And I spin the label around. And it just became, I found that I kept buying the wines from, a half a dozen to a dozen importers who just seem to have great portfolios, whose tastes lined up with mine. So we had Savio on this show last season, right, Savio?
I believe so.
Last season. Yeah. Where we got his whole background. Great story. Born in Brazil, got into food early, parents cooked, really got into tasting and local. Developed a palate for that. Came to New York. Liked going out to clubs and dancing, to support that. Worked in the front of the house at restaurants. Which was a great way to support going to clubs and dancing.
Oh, of course.
And then there was like a marriage or two marriages. You ended up living in Germany, I think, for a bit.
That's right.
And found yourself just traveling and meeting winemakers and getting kind of drawn into the life of the vineyard.
That is true. Pleasure to be here. You know, hello to everybody.
Hello to everybody. Yes. Suarez.
Yes. Well, eating and drinking has been a passion. You know,
word here, me.
It's like music. I mean, I always, right. You know, to me, music, notes that know drive your spirit into a bliss is the same as the palate.
Yeah.
So notes as well that, you know, you always going after you. Yeah. You know, I tend to have a style of music that I listen in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. That is, this helps my day, creates the atmosphere.
Yeah, it's the same and half of the brain too.
Same thing with food and wine. You know, I mean, I'm always thinking of what I'm going to eat today. And coming here, besides, it's a pleasure to be here and seeing you. You know, I just finished a beautiful pizza here at Roberta's. You know, and washed it down with a delicious glass of one of my wines by the glass, a Gamay by Jean-Claude Chanoudet, and I'm happy now.
Well, how can you not be happy with Roberta's pizza and a glass of good Gamay?
That's right.
That's about as good as it gets. Yeah, the pizza here. I mean, haters can hate. People can say whatever they want about this place, but I'll tell you what, the food's really, really solid.
Awesome.
And the pizza's addictive. It's like some of the best pizza I've ever had.
And the atmosphere, you don't know. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It feels like it's midnight.
Who are these people?
You know, it's happening.
The music, packed.
It's packed.
I know.
And you don't know what time of the day it is.
I know.
Or the night.
I know. That's Roberta's. It's its own intoxication.
Awesome. That's New York, too.
It's true, but Brooklyn has its own kind of vibe
going on. Absolutely.
All the kids are out here. They
Brooklyn
love it.
Brooklyn night, and it's the best thing that ever happened to New York.
Where are your offices? You're in Dumbo. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's not far from here at all.
So you got into wine, you're living in Germany, you're meeting small producers, you're meeting vignerons, and then you kind of get this idea of opening the business.
Well, I need to find work. I mean, I moved to Germany, I quit my job at Il Buco, I was the GM there, and, you know...
You were at Buco?
Il Buco,
oh,
yes.
Oh, she's great. Leonard is her last name.
Yes, Donna.
Donna Leonard, she's great. That's
absolutely
such a good place.
I love Il Buco, absolutely love it.
She's a curator, and then she opened Elementaria around the corner on Great Jones,
where
they're killing it.
Absolutely.
Great baking program, great wine list. Both those restaurants are spot on.
They source incredible products and all to work with, and everything else after that is very simple, I believe. You know, I moved to Germany because of 9/11, so to make a long story short, and then took a sabbatic year after that. You know, running out of money, you needed to figure something out. At that time, there was no work in Germany either, and I could not because I could barely speak the language. So for me, you know, one day walking around, like I love to go, I love bookstores. I found this, you know, book on German producers, and I picked it up and I started to email to 100 of them. I got 60 replies, and from that time on, I started to work with 25. Of those producers as an agent, and eventually I just became an importer 2 years later.
So your early portfolio was exclusively Germany?
Was only German.
Because you would never know that now.
No. Selling German wine is like, you know, it's very difficult. It is, you know, Riesling...
Because the perception by the American public in
general? Yes, for sure. Yeah. Because of the terrible négociant wines that were washed into the country here during the 70s and 60s and parts of the 80s. You know, Black Tower,
Blue Nun. Yeah, all that shitty Liebfraumilch that was just terrible wine.
Zeller, Schwarze Katze, and all of that.
Right.
So, I mean, that is not really wine. That is a sweet thing, whatever
factory
that is.
Shit,
that would kill you.
Soda and wine.
The alcohol and the sugar the next day, you'd be dead.
Yeah.
You know, so... That impression is an annoyance, definitely a limitation for the business. Everybody thinks that German wine is like that, and it's not. You know, the professionals, they love German wine.
I'd never forget, I've been in the city about as long as you have, and that Paul Greco was like one of the real early champions, and he had that summer of Riesling every year, where he was giving out the free tattoos, and he was just a great proponent for that particular varietal.
Right, and then actually the most versatile wine, for sure. I mean,
that and Chenin Blanc.
I mean, and the variety from very dry to extremely sweet, and the styles and the regions are so unique and so distinct, and all of that is wonderful. But from that on, immediately I went to France, and you know, I love French wine, and even before anything else, I've always worked for French restaurants, and was very easy for me to go around. At that time, there was no iPhone, so you do it the old
knock on doors.
Old-fashioned way. Knock on doors, hang out at local bars and bistros, and find out who's making wine of interest, of some singular quality, not the sameness, you know. And then from there on, it was easy. Spain, Portugal, Italy, Slovenia, and more to come.
When did you start to hone in? Because if one goes to your website now and hits the About tab or one of those tabs that kind of has something that's edited a few paragraphs about what you're doing, there's a real emphasis now on organic viticulture or bioviticulture or natural wines. I mean, some of these terms have been abused. So organic is a certification you have to pay for. Bio is more of sort of Steiner's philosophy. But you know what I mean, that umbrella of natural wines.
I mean, that basically is
so
very
you
simple.
Have, so I'm going to read it. You had something on your website, and I wrote it down. So you have this. This is how you're kind of defining it, but in broad brushstrokes. No additives, preservatives, agents, cultured yeasts, filtration. I would add fining to that. And in some cases, when you can, zero SO2.
Right. And that happens a lot, zero SO2 these days. But the most important aspect is that the wine industry on our side and on the side of the consumer, I hope, it is for sure, it's evolving in the most beautiful way. Basically, the styles of wines that we drink today has changed a lot for the better, for consideration on purity of flavors and even immense more so on health. Because we basically, we have the option to drink just wine. The only hardest part for the liver there would be the alcohol. No synthetic chemicals and nothing that is strange to wine needs to be there. But for me, we are really lucky to live the days that we live and to be part of this business, which is to me the absolute. It is the most the highest point of the wine industry. For me as an importer, wine is important, but the winemaker is way much more important. Mm. I used to say the winemaker is way much more important, somebody that I get along with, somebody that I respect. And that philosophy developed into something to me even more beautiful, which is how is it that this guy that I like, that I buy his wine, really works? You know, one of the things that I noticed that now is part of what I do, of every new producer that I bring in, is, you know, the hands that are actually working out there in the fields, in the vineyards, are the same hands in the cellar making wine. Mm. So that link, that connection became extremely important. So because of the choices of viticulture, of agriculture, are of the most, of the highest importance to the quality of the wine. And then in the cellar, non-intervention and minimal manipulation is the result of the best wine we have right now. And that, to me, is the most important thing. And that's what I seek when I go out looking for new producers, is this practice.
Yet, and I agree with you, and we'll talk about that in a little more depth in a minute. Yet, if you don't live in a Manhattan or San Francisco or Chicago or an area that's blessed with really great stores, really great importers, great distributors, where you have ready access to this. I mean, for example, I've got friends that live in North New Jersey, not far from here, right? Cross the Hudson River, go in 10 miles, there's a lot of towns. And when I'd go visit them, I'd go into the small town liquor stores which sell wines and just be flabbergasted. There was nothing there I wanted to drink.
You don't need to go that far. You find a lot of that in Uptown, east and west side, you know,
side. But I've been saying that, but you know, I don't know those because I know how to find my way to Discovery Wines. I know that little guy on Elizabeth Street. And if I can go to Chamber Street, I mean, I shop at Flatiron. There's like five stores I go to because they don't have a bad bottle in stock. But when you're talking about, no, I mean, because wine is this weird thing where the wines we're talking about still only constitute under 5% of the wines being made on the planet today.
Maybe even less.
I think so. I mean, you could probably say 1, 2, 3%, yeah. Something like that. So the other 95 is a commodity. I mean, and there's hundreds of additives that you can – I mean, from the industrial farming practices where they're fertilizing and they're spraying – so there's pesticides and there's fertilizers and there's nitrogen and there's who knows what, copper, who knows what else they're spraying. Then they're bringing the wines in, SO2 right away to kill anything that's living on them, buying a commercial yeast, controlling the fermentation tanks with temperature. I mean, micro-oxygenation, reverse osmosis. You can actually take a wine apart and put it back together again to get – so it's you know, a lot of what's out there is just an industrial product.
Wine is a culture. you know, like you pick and buy your music. You want, you know, you go out and you buy music and you bring it home because you like music. Some people just don't buy music. They just listen to the radio. But, you know, we you know, we come from a culture that, you know, we have a lot of LPs in their back.
I do. You know? I've got two MAMS LPs and turntables.
You know, I mean, and wine is the same thing. If you like wine, wine is not the same beverage. It cannot be. If you drink a wine and that is the same exactly flavor profile every year, there's something wrong with that.
Right.
There's something wrong with that because wine should not be that way. It will change and will reflect that growing season. So I personally, as I said, we are lucky because we are part of that small percentage out there. I think New York, Chicago, very much California, LA, San Diego, San Francisco, and Oregon, you know, Portland for sure, Seattle, even DC, we're drinking great wines. I was very surprised for what I see in North Carolina and South Carolina, very much. I was in Nashville, very much interest and the growing interest for natural wines of the style that we work with. And this is very positive. After a trip to Nashville, my first ever now in October, I was surprised by the quality of the food I had there and by a few wine shops, let's say 3 out of 30, that were very similar to what we find here in Brooklyn and the best in Manhattan that carry this style of wine. So I think it's growing and not, that's a fact. There's more and more. And one thing that I also noticed, a lot of Psalms that were, that worked in New York for many years are relocating.
I just saw Fred Dexheimer, you know, Fred's an old friend of mine, kid, he's one of the earliest guys to pass his master psalm. Kids from Podunk, Pennsylvania, middle of nowhere, came to New York, was on the floor for Lauren Torrendale for years, got his master psalm. Now he's in like Raleigh, Durham or something.
He's in North Carolina.
It's crazy.
Sure.
Crazy.
Yes. Same thing. I went to visit the market with my distributor, the person that I represents my portfolio in tenancy, and there, I met people that used to buy my wine here, used to work for Café Bleu, for Gotham, etc., etc. So, and they arrived there, and they're building a wine list with the same wines they had here.
That's great.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about the American food scene. Coast to coast, as you know, we live in this bubble, Manhattan, Brooklyn, you know, this was a really frenetic restaurant scene. But there's so much talent that's passed through cities like ours or San Francisco. And they just want to go home and do something like what Gavin Jason did. You know, Daniel Boulud's chef de cuisine for many, many years at Café Boulud. You know, just went home to wherever he is, Madison, and open up what will be the best restaurant in that city.
In Madison.
Right. A lot of New Yorkers or who people who cut their teeth here, trained here, when the time came to settle down, maybe have a family, maybe the one of the bar. You know, they go back to some hometown and kind of just raise the bar with what the food's like there. And the same with the wine programs.
Well, another important factor for me, from my point of view, is that, you know, there are many new importers popping up every day. Or, let's say, at least one a month. And
yeah,
so
it's interesting.
So
true.
I've been around.
Yeah.
So I have the advantage. But also I decided to move to another direction. I started to expand nationally. So I've been traveling much more in the U.S. So I'm discovering the U.S. in a beautiful way.
Good for
and
you.
By meeting these people that have a lot of experience in New York, you know, bringing that to other markets, it's fun and it's great. I believe, you know, Americans are very open. And they are more curious than other cultures that are traditionalists. So the style of the culture here is like, let me see what this is like. At least they are open to try.
Yeah,
and this
true.
Works out.
It's true. I have to say I couldn't agree more. I'm kind of a Europhile and a Francophobe and Italian folks. I go to Europe all the time. And back in the day when I was cooking in the 80s and 90s, the food and wine there was so much better than what we were doing here. Now the pendulum swung. The ingredients here are astonishing. The viticulture changed. changing. But now when I go back there, like to your point, you know, if you're in Sicily and you want to drink a Nebbiolo or a Sangiovese, they look at you like fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in Bordeaux and you ask anything except a Bordelaise wine, they look at you like no. I'm like, what are you talking about? Whereas in America, where our wine consumption is going up every year, we're one of the only cultures that are drinking more wine per capita annually.
Right.
But we have this really expansive palate where we're not locked into orthodoxy at all.
No, not at all. I mean, I have friends in France. They only drink French wine, and they only drink
specific
Bordeaux,
regions.
Or right. Some they only drink Burgundy. They don't want to try anything else.
Right.
That's it. And that's a limitation. You know, also, I think a new trend, a new vibe in America, it has grounds to grow way faster than any other place. Maybe Japan has that too. Mm. You know, that they take something that really adapts to them, and that goes crazy, spreads very fast. But not in Europe.
No.
In Europe, they're very traditionalist, they're very limited. You know, this makes this market vibrant and wonderful to work at. At the same time, the possibilities. I don't think anyone else in the world is drinking the great wines that are available at most stores and most states here in the U.S.
I know I've got, you know, again, a lot of friends come in from Europe. We go out to dinner, and I'll order wine, and they'll be like, how? I can't buy that wine in my store in Paris. How are you getting these wines? There's so many good vignerons. If they have a single market that they want to target, it's the first market they want to be in is the United States, and the first market in the United States is probably going to be New York.
This is a very important point. I have a lot of producers that I know that 90% is export. And the other 10%, they sell to their friends that have a wine bar in Paris or nearby where they are, etc. So the French people do not benefit from that at all.
Right.
Or even the Italians or the Spanish for that sake. And this is certain, something that I really know. For various reasons, they're not curious. And they will not buy because they don't know, and the price is high, and, you know, I mean, everything will apply to that. So they miss out on the new wine that has been produced out there by very vibrant, young, small grower that work passionately. You know, he spends a lot of time out there in his vineyards. From now, January, they start pruning, and this is when they start making the wine. And it's beautiful. To me, it's a pleasure, a privilege to be part of this, to follow, you know, this method and this work of these people building and creating this new image for the new wine that is here to stay. It's a natural, biodynamic, or organic. It doesn't matter.
I've said this on this show many times, and everyone that knows me is tired of hearing it, but my palate in the last... Once I discovered them, I kind of fell in love with the... There was something about these wines that was alive to me. A bottle of wine that I would open, pour into the glass, or maybe I'd decant it, and it would change... Over the course of an hour and a half, it seemed to change every 10 minutes. It was, you know, just a little this, a little that. The nose was a little bit different. The feel in my mouth was a little different. It was like having a conversation with a bottle of wine that I never felt wines were alive before. And then I got to talk. Did you go to the raw wine event?
Of course.
Yes, so
of course.
I got to talk to Isabel before the event for a while. And we were saying that, you know, when you go back to the wines that I kind of grew up drinking that were made in a standard, you know, post-World War II way of... harvesting the grapes, unfortunately SO2 to kill what was ever on them.
Absolutely.
Using commercial yeasts.
Yes.
And then, you know, racking, fining, filtering. Basically, you have a bottle of wine. It could be very delicious. I mean, you still could get six great glasses at it, but it was kind of like mummified wine. It wasn't going to go anywhere. I mean, the only thing that would happen might be the tannins would soften over time. You know,
well, that's the varietal, that's the region, that's the style, so that's...
But the wine and the mummification thing, I said, that's like the perfect way to think of it. It's like they took something that was alive and then killed it and preserved the shit out of what was left of that corpse, and that's what you're drinking, versus the wines today. And even to your point about fining and filtering, you know, I think about when I'm back in the old days when I was working the floor of restaurants. Roger Daghorn was one of my first sommeliers. I mean, back when I didn't know what a master somm was in 1985. I had no idea.
That's right.
He had the little testivan around his neck.
Exactly.
And you think of the purpose of that testivan, that little silver cup, was in the old days, they would pour wine into it, swirl it around. It has those dimples because it would reflect light. So the wine had to be clear and clean and pure. And then I began to think, like, now in the modern times, like, why do we filter wines like this? Why are we finding out those lees and that bacteria? So much of that stuff is going to speak to me in the bottle 6 months, a year later, in the glass in terms of the terpenes and the esters and the texture of the wine. Why do we strip it out? Because that's how we used to
judge. Pleasure that was stripped out of the wine, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Because, you know, every action, every processing, you take something from the wine. So I think that today the style is there. It's nuanced wines. Restrained, and balance, purity of flavors. I mean, some wines we drink, they express such a beauty in flavors, in balance, in the whole experience. It's like you get enchanted.
Yeah, no, I had
you
one.
Know, it fills you with joy.
I had a Cab Franc last night from, I think it was from Chamber Street. Just a little producer, Anjou, and it was just such a pleasure. Like every sip put a smile. I decanted it, let it blow off a little bit because I read a little bit about it. You know, again, a bio wine, just completely minimalist, but just this wonderful expression of Cab Franc that was silky and luscious and wonderful and soft and changed 20 times over the course of the hour and a half that I drank it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the pleasure that we get from drinking wines like this is unspeakable. I go even beyond. As we talk about what is biodynamics, biodynamics has to do with energy, right? With influences of everything that's around us. So we are human beings. We also influence with energy.
Yeah.
So I believe and I feel it sincerely, the energy of the winemaker in the wine.
And no, then, I completely. There's something.
Yeah.
So in Isabelle's book on natural wines,
right,
which came out a couple of years ago, she talked about that French word, vivant.
Uh-huh.
There's something, and I've just you capture it.
Right.
Once you experience it, you never lose that sense of life in a bottle. That these wines that we're drinking, that are these bio wines, some of them with zero SO2, just a pure expression of the fruit. They grow the grapes properly, crush them, let the fermentation happen with indigenous yeasts, let it go through mallow or not, whatever, and then bottle it most of the time, barely filtered and not fined. You just have these wonderful expressions of they're alive.
Absolutely. I have the privilege of knowing the winemakers, and some of them I'm very close to. I speak to them very often, so we have a real relationship. So when I open a bottle of their wine, there's so much of them in that bottle that I feel like I'm talking to them a little bit. I mean, I have a producer, Frank Baltazar in Cornas. Frank is one-man show. I mean, he's making the most beautiful wine.
So 100% Syrah.
100% Syrah. And now he's making the most beautiful wines. I mean, small batches, everything old vines. And he used to have only 8 Demi Mui. You know, 600 liter barrels in his cellar. So that's not a lot of wine for a producer. But, you know, his wine is so beautiful. I'm so close to him. Mm. It's a person that I talk to constantly. He makes his wines now. He's making some of his wines for the past 3 years. He started to experiment, but now that is a fact, without adding sulfites. The wines are so much better. The wines are so much more digestive. And a pleasure to drink, lighter, nuanced, restrained, elegant, and to me,
which is really because one of my criticisms a little while back of the Northern Rhone is it was going the other way.
The other way.
You were getting
modern.
These Syrahs that were just getting bigger and tarrier and heavier and more extracted. And I remember saying to my son, because he's really into wine now, you know, I prefer Grenache in the for the most part.
Right.
You know, I prefer going in the Southern Rhone just because it's a much lighter style.
Right.
Grenache driven than those
should not be.
Big. I know it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
I mean, by itself, Syrah is not this big burly grape. It's just that's the style.
Yeah. But you know, to me, the weight of Frank's wine is Pinot Noir,
which is crazy.
Which is Syrah,
right?
I mean, for me to refer to a wine like this as very pretty, because it is. It's very, very elegant. There's no weight. There's no pressure.
So you and I, we're going to have to wrap it in a second, but I think it's funny because I'm older than you were, but, you know, not by a ton. And again, I kind of grew up in the restaurant business in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s were the eras. And back then, winemaking was maybe kind of at its, I don't want to say its worst, but it was being driven by points and Parker and scores. And it was all about over-extraction, now that I look back on it.
Right.
It was about a lot of alcohol, a lot of fruit. The use of oak was uninhibited. And it was just. And now I found that my palate's just swung 180 degrees the other way. And I find those wines undrinkable.
And it's impossible to go back.
It's impossible.
Impossible to go back.
I keep this little list. I get this little wine book from the year.
Right.
I keep a list of these grapes that I fell in love with like over the last 5 years. Pellaverga from Piemonte, which is a wonderful thing. Schiava, Ruque, Cerezuolo, Grignolino, of course, Pinot Noir, Pinot Doni from the Loire.
Right.
Of course, Gamay, Nerello Mascalese from Italy.
Right.
Frappato.
Of course.
Just these wines that are direct and fresh and work with food.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's where
And they keep coming up. There's more. There are more and more grapes coming out. I just have a wine now that is produced in the part of Tuscany that is more Ligurian than Tuscany, next to Carrara. It's actually a blend of Sangiovese and Massaretto. I had never heard of Massaretto before.
Me neither.
And the wines are, again, beautiful. It's restrained, nuanced, elegant. Nothing massive. Something that you can have with a delicious radicchio salad with beets and walnuts if you want.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's the beauty of that, you know? There are a lot happening in each country, not just in Europe, but also here in the U.S. and other countries about autochthonous grapes. Everything is original. We don't need to be drinking Cab Sauvignon or Merlot from Tuscany anymore.
Right. I know. Please. I mean, if somebody makes it... We need another drop of, like, you know, a world style Chardonnay.
Super
like we
Tuscan, need, right, exactly.
If I drink one more Oaky Tuscan from, I mean, I was in Sicily and I went to Planeta and they showed me, and I'm like, you know, I really like it, but why are you making this? Like, why does the world need another drop of this stuff?
I mean, the next thing to me somehow in Piemonte that is producing interesting wines that have a different style is Roero.
Mm.
Roero is not like Alba or Barolo. The soil is way lighter, so the wines have a completely different profile. And I'm very much in love with the RNAs and with the Nebbiolo from these regions in the hands of biodynamic producers.
And Nebbiolo is another one of those grapes that can be it could be big like a Bocello or an upright base.
Absolutely.
And it can be like a harpsichord.
Absolutely.
Depending on what soil type, what elevation, how you want to handle it, it's a crazy grape.
Absolutely.
We're gonna get you in the spring.
It would be a pleasure.
Thanks so much. My guest, as you know, this show is one of those shows you tune into.
It's great to be here.
Great to be here. Savio Suarez, if you see his wine, Savio Suarez Selection, get them. He's one of my favorites. You know, him, Zev, Jenny and Francois, Louis Dresner. There's a bunch of them out there. I think that Severin Peru actually has their own importing company now. Speaking of... That's the Somme from Ten Bells is beginning to bring in their own. But I love them all. Their wines are wonderful. They're just great to explore. Thanks so much, Savio, for
pleasure
coming
to
in.
Be here. And
have a great
see
Christmas,
you again,
Hanukkah, and New Year's. We'll see you in 2017.
Likewise.
17.
Happy holidays.
Yes, stay tuned. We're going to have Erin Healy in. She's now the Somme at John George. She's great. She's smart. She's young. She's all about it. So stay tuned for that. And she's going to blind taste me Bordeaux's. Wow, I can't wait. Hey folks, Mike Hellameco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was a chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home? that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, this soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing. Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds tell all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux aisle, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Hey, folks, welcome back. I guess I shouldn't call this show Food Talk if we're just going to talk about wine the entire hour. But what the hell? That's what we're doing. Anyway, so it's back. We're back. Erin Hughes is my guest. She's been on the show before. We met in September of 2015. In Bordeaux. I remember because that's where we were. We were there for the same reason. She was with Patrick Capiello and his band of young, brilliant American somms from all over the country. Erin was part of the New York contingent, the New York team.
Yes, indeed.
And what struck me most about, well, we were there for the harvest and to taste the wine. It was a great year. 2015 was a great year. All the vignerons were happy. The weather was fantastic. And Patrick was kind of trying to showcase Bordeaux wines to like a young generation of somms, because a point I've been making for years is that Bordeaux, I think, sort of blew it in the 90s and early aughts by just kind of forgetting the American market and selling to China or wherever the hell they were selling, and, you know, not getting value wines out there because the first growths are so expensive. Who can really drink them? But what was impressive was all these young somms, like, how the hell do you know this much about wine? And you're like, you were like 23 then or 24 or something.
I was 24, yeah.
You were a kid. And then I got you on this show and you told me, like, it was a great story, like the whole bio about your military kid, dad traveled.
Yeah.
You ended up going to college in Scotland.
Dublin.
And then they didn't have like sororities, but they had clubs, and you joined the wine club.
Indeed.
And got to travel, because as everyone knows, if you've been to Europe, like, it's kind of easy to get around with like a Euro pass, and you can just kind of hop, skip, and jump. You can cross borders. Maybe back then you needed a passport, but it's gotten easier. Well,
it doesn't get any better than being an 18-year-old American in Europe, being able to drink wine and eat food and travel around.
Correct, because the drinking age is like 15, or if there is one, if it's even enforced. But, and then you studied. I mean, you got your SOM certification. You were like 21, and you were like living out west just studying.
No, so I actually waited. I worked for the State Department in between.
You did?
I did. I wanted to be a 007 agent. I wanted to be like James Bond 2.0, the female version.
Okay. You can still do that through wine. You can fool everybody. Yeah. Everyone thinks it's Erin Healy, the SOM, and then it turns out that you're packing and you've got a concealed carry permit and you've got two black belts and explosives.
You never know.
And you can defuse bombs.
You never know what's under that blazer.
You never do know. You were working for Mark Forgione then, and then in the last, I mean, I know you from Facebook. This is like the weird way we all know each other now, sort of. It's like, oh, look. And I remember asking you, like, because you had all these posts about, like, Erin in the kitchen or something. What is she making? Why are you making nudie at home in Connecticut? Like, what is
it's
this?
It's like my yoga. It's
apparently, because you do some badass shit. I'm like, are you more? I remember asking you once, like, did you switch from front of the house to back of the house? And I hope not.
I have to give so much credit to my chefs at Forge, because we would go out for beers after work or just be hanging around. And I always have been super interested in the culinary side of things, but I just enjoy it as a process. Like, it's the kind of thing like writing a menu and doing prep and cooking and making a sauce and then serving it and plating it is something very therapeutic for me. Like, my mom's a yoga teacher and has been trying to get me to do yoga for forever, and it's not going to happen. I've tried. I can't get out of my own head. But for some reason, I can turn it all off when I cook.
Good.
So,
well, that's something most chefs have in common, too. Like, so, we all just got into it because we just love the process of it.
So, I mean, I would just go in and be like, I'm having trouble. Chris Zabita, if you're listening, will laugh at me because he used to make fun of me because I would take pictures of my seared scallops and he'd be like, that's a terrible sear. And I'm like, well, you need to teach me how to sear a scallop. But they were so supportive of just helping me technically. And I feel like, you know, when I go home, I learn and I grow. And it's been something that I do on the side, but I just love it.
Well, you spent the summer cooking, apparently, because your Facebook pages were full of, like, really, like, technical-looking restaurant-style shit at home.
Always on the grill.
And then you were in Europe. You traveled a lot, too. You were all over. You were in Italy, Burgundy. Where were you?
I went back to France.
You did.
I did an exchange in Champagne when I was 16, and my parents there are really like my second parents. So for me, it was very important to go back and see them after 4 years, but also to go back and revisit my friends all over the country. So I took my parents to Bordeaux, actually, for their 30th wedding anniversary. And we went back to the Le Flacon.
Where they must know you on a first-name basis.
You know, Gilles and I have a constant text relationship. And I went and I revisited some of the places that we were all at last year. Guillaume from Chateau d'Armagnan des Ormes in Sauternes blind tasted me on every vat and every barrel, which was really fun.
How cool is that?
We were there. All the wines that I was tasting out of the vats were the things that he was harvesting when we were there last year. So that was a really cool process for me.
To connect.
And it was the same thing at Chateau Le Puy. All the barrels that I tasted out of last year were being bottled the day that I was there. So they literally put a bottle under the machine and pulled it back out, and we tasted the wines that I had tasted out of barrel. And the same thing with what they were harvesting the year before. I got to taste the juice of the grapes that we saw last year. So it was a really interesting process for me as a sommelier, because how often do you get to go back every year and do that process like a winemaker does?
You don't.
So it was really special, and everyone was so unbelievably generous, and they're so incredible out there. I really appreciate everything that they do for me and for my family.
And then you're on the floor at John George. Congratulations.
Yes. Yeah, I'm a new cuisine at John George. Yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, so do you do both rooms?
Yeah. So I am currently full-time in Nougatine and then help out in the room.
Oh, good, because I'll see more. I mean, I don't eat at John George proper much, but I kind of always like that front room because it's such a good value. I mean, it's the same kitchen, slightly different menu, but it's not as expensive, not as committed. I don't think that's... Is there a dress code in John George?
Yes.
And
yes.
There is.
Yes.
There isn't one in Nougatine.
Coat required.
Yeah, see, that's why.
But you still can't wear shorts in Nougatine.
I don't really wear shorts after September anyway. I know I live in Cape May when I'm not here, but down by me they wear shorts all year long.
You know, it's a really fun setup because the wine list is the same over the whole restaurant. So
how's the cellar? It's crazy.
It's insane.
It's insane.
It's insane. We opened a bottle of 1945 Chateau Latour, I believe it was last week. Out of the cellar.
Did somebody order it?
Someone ordered it, yeah.
So you had to take... I mean, you never know.
Well, you know, we taste pretty much every bottle we open because it's quality control at that point.
I watch Pascal, I watch you. I mean, every good psalm worth their his or her...
Right.
So they has to. Pour it in a glass, give it the nose. What's an organoleptic? What's it look like? Let's taste it. Spit. Good to go.
If it's a bad bottle, you know, we don't want it to hit the table because it's all about, you know, making sure the customer gets... We know exactly what they want and what they're ordering, and if it's cooked or corked, then it should never be there. You know, obviously, like, no one's perfect and everyone makes mistakes, but you know, generally, if we can catch it, then it's and
so
it's
how
not
was
get there.
The 45 Latour?
It was perfect,
un-effing believable.
You know, we opened 3 bottles of 45 that week. We opened
four. So customers, like, who are these balls? Can I ask what the price is on the menu? Is it like under $3,000 or something?
No,
or it's more than $3,000. Yes. Was it Donald Trump's table? Was it Mitt Romney? Okay, because he was there. Did you wait on them? Were you here that night?
I was there that night.
Oh, God. I even mentioned, uttered the name. Sorry.
They were extremely polite customers. You know, I actually have a lot of respect for the Secret Service. They were extremely nice gentlemen, and they have to do a job, and they worked with us very... They worked very hard to make everything
right.
work with us.
Sort of normal as it could possibly be.
As it could possibly be.
Yeah. So the wine list at John George is international with a focus on France? Big focus on France?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, we're a French restaurant, and we've got quite a bit of Alsace.
Yeah, well, he's Alsatian.
Yes. And very heavy on Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Okay. So we still... So what did that 45 cost? I mean, are we allowed to say that? It's on the wine list. No one can go and look, right? It's on the sneaky list for rich people. Is it over $5,000?
Yes.
All right, I'm done. Okay, on another note. So speaking of $5,000 wines, today you have a challenge. We're laying down a gauntlet, Michael Meko, because you guys have heard. Well, I've never been in a restaurant where you were on the floor because I had never made it to Forgione, and I don't go uptown much. But you're going to see me at John George. I'm going to text you because I work out every day at the athletic club, so I'm like around the corner.
I gave you enough flack for not coming in the Mark Forgione. You know it's going to be even more flack if you don't come see me at JG.
I have to come see you at John George. So today's challenge is this. We have 6 glasses of a mystery red wine, but we know they're from Bordeaux.
Yes.
We don't know if it's left bank or right bank, and I'm probably not going to go out on a limb and guess, unless it's really obvious, whether they're left bank or right bank, cab driven or Merlot driven. My challenge is to figure out what the price of each wine is.
Price point, yes.
Price point of each wine. All right, so let's start. Yes. Where should I start? Because you want to, I don't want to confuse
it. The glass towards you is one, and it's going to go backwards.
Okay. All right, so this is glass number one. All right, here we go. Dun-dun-dun-dun. You're going to have to talk while I'm tasting, otherwise we have dead air on the radio.
I mean, the thing that I think is so important when talking about Bordeaux and price points is that, you know, even a wine list like my wine list doesn't do any favors for people's perception of what Bordeaux is actually putting out. You know, these first growths, second growths, classified growths, you know, whatever... that are on the auction market and on the unpremier market that, you know, you see in these movies like Red Obsession, or they talk about them in the new documentary Spoiled Grapes on Netflix.
Have you seen that?
It's great.
Is it great?
Maybe
watch it tonight.
It's well worth watching. I really enjoyed it.
What's that about?
It's about...
The fraud?
The fraud,
I saw it already, actually. Yeah, it was really good. That's a crazy story.
You know what I really appreciate them talking about is why those wines are priced like they're priced. And the interesting thing is that, you know, you see a wine list like that, and everyday Bordeaux wines are sitting right next to classified growths with a lot of zeros behind them. And how do you distinguish between the two? And one of the biggest questions I get at Nougatine when I'm working is people go, oh, well, is it really worth that much money, or why does it cost so much? And a lot of those wines, especially when they have three zeros after them, the thing is that you can't even treat them like regular wine anymore because they're a part of a whole different thing. They're a part of a...
Supply and demand.
It's like the fine art market.
Yeah, it's like supply... I mean, it's almost like supply and demand. There's not a lot of it made. See, I mean, why do these California cabs cost what they cost?
But
why?
Even beyond that is that it's not even a supply and demand market like an allocation market because, I mean, there can be a highly allocated wine that demands a certain price, but with three zeros behind it, that's not just an allocation issue.
Yeah.
Something like the 45 Bordeaux, or 45 Latour, you should treat like a Picasso in that sense. It's going to be on an auction market. It's going to be in a private cellar, and people trade wine of that category like the fine art. So you really can't think of it in the same category as normal, the normal wine market. It's a completely separate entity. And I think when you think about it that way, it's less scary.
I don't drink. I mean, who? I guess at John George you see those. Let me see wine number two, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Wine number two. All right. So keep going. I love listening to you talk about wine. And I've got a taste, and I can't taste to talk at the same time.
So it's just something that I think for Bordeaux, for a very long time, it was something that was inaccessible. It was something that the price points on wine lists scared people. And these huge flights that you see with just tons of zeros, people don't even want to look at that section of the wine list because it's intimidating or make, you know, whatever it does to people's perceptions.
It's intimidating. It's bloody intimidating.
Though that being said, I think it's changing. I think things like the Spoiled Grapes documentary really helps people understand when they lay it out so plainly like that. Helps people understand why those prices are what they are and kind of make people focus on the things that are maybe a little bit more accessible. And I think, you know, the CIVB is doing a really, really good job of...
What's the CIVB?
The Bordeaux Wine Council.
Yes, yes, yes.
Is doing a really great job of bringing the 97% of wine that is produced in Bordeaux to the forefront versus the 3% of the classified growths that participate in non-primer and end up costing so much more due to the market that's been created there.
Those damn Bordelais. They did it to themselves.
However it happens, it's one of those things. You know,
number three.
It's business. It's
business. It is what it is. And we should talk about, this is something weird. All right, because this only exists in Bordeaux. It's only Vin Premier. So in Bordeaux, somehow it became a tradition years back for the big winemakers to work with Négociant, which is their own little animals, right?
Yeah.
And they would take a harvest. Like, we were there for 2015. So I get invited. I went to the En Premier twice. So I get invited every year from I don't go anymore because I don't get it. You know, for me, tasting wines out of the barrel that are 6 months old makes no sense either. But that's me. But the idea is that they invite all the press. They invite a lot of people. And you're tasting barrel samples of wine that may or may not be what they bottle eventually in terms of blends anyway. You're tasting barrel samples of wine 6 months after the harvest, but a lot of the wine's sold at that point.
Yeah.
So they're getting paid before, like way before. These wines won't be released for 2 years and change.
Yeah.
Right? But it only exists in Bordeaux.
It's a very interesting and unique system, and I think it spiraled out of control based on the nature of the system, but I don't think anyone ever intended it for it to get to what it is today.
The beast that it is.
You know, it's capitalism and the, you know, how those auction markets work and to be perfectly honest, it's like way above my head when it gets into like serious numbers. I was terrible at economics class, so for me it's a beast of its own, but it definitely was its own upcoming and its own downfall at the same time. But you know, those wines are incredible and they have history and you know, for me, like tasting that 1945 Chateau Latour,
that's insane.
And the fact that it was perfect,
bright and fresh and alive.
Oh, it was,
it's not brown. It's not leafy. It's
so crunchy.
That's crazy.
And delicious.
That's crazy. But then you think 45, if you go back, I mean, just as a snapshot, we just had Savio here back in 45. This was before fertilizer. These were natural yeasts. I mean, this was kind of like winemaking that we're swinging, that we're calling now non-interventionist, but really pre-World War II, that's kind of how everyone was making wine.
Well, and, you know, like...
Can I get wine number four?
Oh, there's just three wines.
Oh, there's just three wines. So
oh,
you
yeah.
have... Okay, damn, girl. Okay, sorry. So you poured sick glasses. All right. That would have really made me look bad.
But you know, it's I don't like to downplay those wines because they are great and so many and they age so well and you taste those iconic vintages and it's really an ethereal experience when you taste those wines. That being said, I wouldn't be able to taste those wines if I didn't do what I do. So
you wouldn't have gotten a job at John George if you weren't a star kid.
So, you know, it's just one of those things that for me I really revel in the history of it and the opportunity to taste those things and how great they really are. But in everyday life, you have to like take a step back and understand that's not the everyday for most people. And so I appreciate them for what they are. But when I'm picking wines for my dinner parties or on my dinner table, I'm going to take a totally different approach, which is why we're here.
All right. So I'm ready to go. Got to fire away here. So I've got to pick the most expensive, least expensive, middle priced wine.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Drum roll, folks. Here we go. One last time. We're sniffing away here. We're doing this. We're just getting our second thoughts out of our head. All right. I think I'm kind of torn between one and two. I thought three was the least expensive. That's my guess. My guess is three is the least expensive. I don't know why. I'm thinking it's... That could be wrong. It seems like it's mostly Merlot. Doesn't seem to have much oak on it. There is oak. There is oak, but not much. So three is the least expensive.
We're on a timetable here, Mike. Gotta make a decision.
Yeah, I know, the master sounds. What do they get, 26 minutes for six glasses? That must be fucking torture. The whole fucking world ends on it. And then last year, there was 63 people took the test and two passed?
Yeah, it's
I don't really want to think about that shit. All right, I'm thinking one that costs the most money, two's in the middle, three's the least expensive.
Well, you were right on one end.
Jesus.
That's so nice. The wine number three is the Chateau Trocart. It's 2010 and it's $20 a bottle.
Okay. So there I'm right.
So that wine is Merlot predominant with Cabernet Sauvignon and that's Cabernet
my
Franc.
Note. My note says Merlot, least expressive oak. Okay, that was number three.
Yeah, it's 70% Merlot with 15 Cabernet Sauvignon, 15 Cab Franc. But to be perfectly honest, this wine is
delicious.
Very smooth.
Yeah, it's delicious.
It's full body and it's classic. It is what people think of when they think of Bordeaux.
So the first wine, so I'm getting like black fruit and bramble and these integrated kind of soft tannins. It kind of had me in the right bank, to be honest with you. I don't know why I thought it was the most expensive, but I did.
Well, you're on the left bank still.
Really?
But that being said, you're kind of hitting the nail on the head with the soft tannins because we do have this 2005 Chateau Briette. So it is
05,
also
great vintage.
Merlot predominant.
Okay, so I don't feel too bad.
Hey,
I kind of sensed that was mostly Merlot, that those high-toned fruit notes, and again, that sort of black fruit and
exactly.
Soft silky tannins. What's that go for?
It's 48% Merlot, 40% Cabernet Sauvignon, 9% Cabernet Franc, and 3% Petit Verdot for $33 a bottle. And for 05 Bordeaux that's drinking well,
It's a great price. 05 was a solid year. It was delicious wine.
Yeah.
So what's the big gun number two that I fucked up on?
So do you think it was right or left bank?
I thought this was more Cabernet. I felt like the second one had more Cabernet Sauvignon. And I was even getting... Really, I did. I don't know why. I did. So I'm totally fucking wrong with that. And I was actually almost getting that weird, like, that pyrazine you get from Cab Franc, like that peppery thing. And
all have bad days, Mike.
Fuck me. So it's...
this is the Chateau Le Pont.
Okay.
Pomerol. So predominantly Merlot with
right.
Cabernet Franc. So you did get the Cabernet Franc on the net.
I did get the Cab Franc. And why do they say that iron... That, like, that... Pomerol, you got iron in the soil there.
Yes.
So you almost sometimes get like a...
You've got an iron pan under the clay, so you get that kind of bloody...
Right, like you get like organ meat, like you'd get from like liver kind of, which is a weird thing from wine, but I remember like that's one of the sort of weird notes with Pomerol.
Yeah.
Oh, well. I guess I've... You know what? I mean, all I can say is I've got to go back to Bordeaux because I got to brush up. I mean, I got one out of three sort of, like one and a half because I got the varietal and the other one. But I think we just have to get us... I think we all have to go back to Bordeaux.
I think we should all go back
together.
Stay
in that same hotel and go out to dinner every night and then end the night at Flacon, whatever it's called, with that kid with the Instagram account.
Yes.
What's that kid from the West
Anthony.
Coast?
Anthony. Anthony Vales-Kalen.
Holy shit.
That kid is incredible.
Yeah, they were all... You guys were so fun. I was stuck with...
Did you see him when he was in New York? He was in New York a couple weeks ago.
No. I didn't see him. No.
And Max was in New York a couple weeks ago, too.
So what does the last bottle cost?
The last bottle is $45.
Well, that's not, I mean, for what it is. It's delicious.
It's really nice. I think it's definitely that classic Pomerol. It's still got a little bit of that like tannic structure that you want from Bordeaux to cut those fatty meats like, you know, ribeye or
steak
or pork. Especially, you know, things like ribeye, pork, you know, things like that during Christmas season. If that's what's on your Christmas table, like these are really perfect wines for the holiday season.
Post these wines on the website. We'll do that for shoppers out there because they're all, I guess, they're relatively available.
Yes.
In stores
yes.
near. So how did you just, for quick, in the last minute or two, how did you, the job at John George, how'd you hear about it? I'm just curious. Like, how's that work?
I just sent somebody an email asking if they were hiring.
Like the old fashioned, like knock on the door.
Yeah.
And you just happened to get them at the right time when they were looking?
Yeah. It really was that perfect timing dynamic.
And so they interview, so you come in and they just kind of want to get to know you. So how does that work?
You know,
because I don't know how the whole SOM, this is too personal. I just don't know how the whole SOM thing works. Like with chefs, it's like, you know, resume and then you get referred by your chef to another chef and, you know.
I'm so grateful to be a part of the team there. It's such an incredible group of people. And I what I really respect about the company as a whole is they really want people with the right mindset. They want people with the right attitude and who work well with others and who have a really team spirit. Mm. And you can really tell that that's, you know, a something that they look for in people because it feels that way. It's an incredible team. And like I did my staff training, my Bordeaux staff training yesterday morning. And it's really fun to have people from back of house and people from front of house all sit around the same table and all be super excited about what you're doing as a team.
That's great to hear that you're doing that too. Because I remember when Mike Madrigal was up at Bar Balloud, he would have distributors come in, I think on Thursdays or Fridays, and they would blind taste everybody. There was no kitchen staff, but they would blind taste everyone in the dining room, from like the runners to the bussers to the, I mean, and everyone had like an opinion. So it's kind of great to sort of democratize the world of wine.
Absolutely.
Congratulations, man.
Thanks.
Team John, I mean, he's just, I when he first came to New York, he was at the Drake Swiss Hotel, and I was at the Maurice under Deluvrier, and we all kind of, who's this guy, man? He just came in, because back then New York was so different. There wasn't that many restaurants, and you know, he was coming in, he was a big wig, and he got 3 stars from the Times. And his cooking was so different. We went to eat at that, we all went to eat at the Drake. And like, you know, this guy had this really, I mean, you could tell he had been to Asia. He had this really light aesthetic. The sauces weren't reduced. He was using a lot more broth. It was just so, and he's just, he has been like a beacon since then. This is like a 30-year career where he's just been spot on.
He's incredible. And he's always there too. If he's in New York, he's there. And it's really amazing to work at the flagship where he's there all the time. It's a whole different energy when the person who created it all is still present and active, and which he is in everything that we do.
Yeah, lives downtown, lives in the Village, and he's up there all the time. And no, it's so great. I mean, he's a chef. I have nothing but respect for the guy. And I have never filmed there, which is crazy. So maybe now that you're there, we'll see if we can't get TV cameras in for the PBS series.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
We should do that, because then I can get you on the floor, too, and get you with a microphone or stick a mic, get you on camera. Thanks for coming on. Erin Healy's been my guest. Erin Healy can be found on the floors of Nougatine and John George most any day. She's great. You're like 26, 7 now?
I'm 25 still.
Fuck me.
She's I'm almost
like
26,
baby.
Though.
This is crazy. Like, I don't know. Like, I remember coming home from that trip and trying to describe the trip and saying, you know, I birdwatch because I live in Cape May, and like it's like one of the greatest birdwatching places in the world because they just all come through. So, and I said it's like weird. It's like discovering like a new species of bird that like no one saw before. Like, who are these 22-year-olds and all this shit about wine? And it was like a busload of you fools, and you're like all over.
Yeah,
I know, it's so cool. God bless. That's great. Thanks for coming
on.
Absolutely. All right, stay tuned, folks. Next week's the last show of the season. We'll be back on in January, and I've got 3 guests to talk about. I don't know what, food safety and some other stuff. 3 guests next week, though. So it's going to be a big bang, 20-minute, 20-minute, 20-minute show. Thanks, Erin Healy, for coming out. Let's raise a glass. We'll raise the expensive glass to Bordeaux.
Cheers, Mike.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.